Thank you very much, and I'm very happy to accept the invitation and support those people.
You're listening to a community forum on the Downing Street Memos with Congressman Maurice Hinchey, held July 6th in Binghamton. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, or WZKW Kingsville. We continue.
My son was in Iraq. It's ironic to me that he has to come back now and pay off the entire cost of this war because it's all going into the national debt.
Question is about the national debt and the fact that the gentleman's son is a veteran of the Iraq War and fortunately survived it, has now come back and has to begin to pay off this huge debt. Well, I think you know what's going on with regard to the economics of this country from the federal perspective. We have every year increasing budget deficits. And those increasing budget deficits are due to the economic policies of this administration acquiesced in by the Congress. And those budget deficits are very severe. Budget deficits are growing so much that the national debt has now almost doubled since George Bush came into office. The national debt now is approaching $8 trillion. And very quietly, the Congress, in its recent budget resolution, raised the debt ceiling to $9.8 trillion, anticipating that the national debt will continue to grow. Now, what does it mean to have this national debt? It means that we are selling our paper, bonds and notes. Who is buying them? Increasingly, they're being bought by the Chinese. China is buying up more and more of our debt obligations. Japanese buy a great deal. South Korea buys a great deal. Other countries as well. Most of it is going in that direction, however. And this is creating a situation that cannot be sustained. This debt is going to have to be paid back. It's going to have to be paid back by future generations, by your son, the veteran, and by his children as well, unless we begin to turn it around. But this administration has created this debt intentionally. When the administration took office, they were inheriting a circumstance of budget surplus and foreseeable budget surpluses for all the years ahead. They have intentionally turned that around. They turned it around by changing the economic policies. The first thing that they did was to rush four tax cuts, one right after another, through the Congress, the Republican-controlled Congress. And the major benefits of these tax cuts go to people who are making more than $1 million a year. Not just millionaires, people who have $1 million, say, in the bank or stocks or property, but people who are bringing in more than $1 million every year, year after year. They are the primary beneficiaries. They get the biggest benefits. The recent budget gives $106 billion of additional tax cuts to those wealthiest people in the country and the biggest corporations, including oil companies, who have more money than they know what to do with. That's why we have these huge debts, and of course the war. The cost of the war now is far above $200 billion, approaching $300 billion. It's costing us roughly about $5 billion a month to continue the war in Iraq. That's why we have these deficits, and that's why they recently raised the debt ceiling to $9.8 trillion in anticipation of additional deficits. Now, they've done that to give those tax breaks away, to carry out this war, but also to deprive us as a society, as a country, of the resources we need to carry out our activities to make us a stronger, better nation internally, here at home. You know the story about Social Security. president goes around the country saying we can't afford Social Security anymore, so we have to privatize it. What a big lie. Big total lie. They say the same thing about national health insurance. My God, we can't afford national health insurance because we have these huge budget deficits. How could we possibly afford national health insurance? That's why they created the budget deficits in the first place, so that they could make that case. Sorry, we can't afford environmental protection. Sorry, we can't afford affordable housing. We don't have the money. We've got huge budget deficits. Sorry, we can't afford the money to build up the basic infrastructure of our society. We don't have enough money to improve our sewer treatment plants. We don't have enough money to replace ancient, decrepit water supply systems and sewer systems. We don't have the money. Sorry, we can't do it. These people have the nerve then to talk about patriotism. They have the nerve to say that while they're destroying the country, they don't want anybody to burn the flag. Don't burn the flag while we destroy the country. That's what they're doing. We need people to stand up. We need a new Congress. We need a new administration. We need to do this by virtue of the ballot. And if they try to corrupt the ballot, then at some point the people of this country will go back to the streets. I don't want to see that happen. That's why we need to make these changes now, and we need to do them in an orderly, sensible, intelligent way. We need a new government in America.
Thank you for your hard work. I need to vent a little bit. We went to Iraq.
Take the mic.
So we could free the people there so they have liberties, so the women can get elevated in the society. But yet, we are losing our liberties. And depending on how the Supreme Court turns out, women may be losing some of their liberties and their rights. And yet we're over there to give them what we are losing. We can't account for billions of dollars that are over there for repairs. The repairs are being paid in cash, not checks. We can't account for the billions of dollars. And yet we can't, that billions of dollars could get healthcare, could help the seniors with their medication that they can't afford, and yet nothing's being said about that. Where's the outrage on China wanting to come in and buy an oil company in the United States? Why isn't anybody speaking up on it? Where's the outrage on these things? I know you haven't got all the answers, but don't the people notice? And why isn't there any commissions looking into some of these things? Thank you.
Well, some of us are speaking up about it, about the attempt by China to buy Unocal, by the Supreme Court decision that said that it's all right to take over private property for commercial enterprises, the New London decision that came down just the last couple of weeks, which is an outrageous decision against private personal property, against homeowners in lower income neighborhoods particularly, who would be susceptible to that kind of acquisition. We are speaking out about it. But remember, we've got this unilateral government in America today. We have a Congress that acquiesces to the administration. We have people working in uniform there. And the only way that we're going to get real progress is by changing that government. Jack?
First of all, I thank you also for coming, but I know you've been in the military yourself, honorable service, and we appreciate that. But I don't think we really have a volunteer army. We have a very highly recruited, pressure-recruited army, and they're destroying the National Guard and the spirit of the National Guard and the reserve. What can we do to turn this around, or do we have to go to a draft to share the pain?
Well, one of the consequences of the illegality and the injustice and irresponsibility of the war in Iraq has been the weakening of our military. Our military today is weaker than it has been, I don't know since when, but for a long time. Our military today is very weak. And The likelihood of people joining the military is declining very substantially. We have seen situations where reservists have been sent to Iraq and then been forced to sign up for another term, gone back again 2-3 times, sometimes more. Army National Guard, the same thing. All of this is causing the military to be weaker. Now, the administration is not going to call for a draft because they know that if they call for a draft, that is going to broaden the opposition to the war. That's what happened in Vietnam, remember. When we instituted the draft, when the government instituted the draft, the opposition to the Vietnam War began to broaden and broaden and broaden. This administration is not going to bring about a draft, in spite of the fact that if they cared a whit about the military, that's what they would do. Because the military in Iraq is overburdened. Many of them have been sent in there without the proper equipment. That's why so many lives have been lost, because the equipment was defective, deficient. Simple things like bulletproof and shrapnel-proof vests were not available. Humvees were not armored. But billions of dollars were being paid to Kellogg, Brown, and Root to charge 4 times the amount that they paid for oil in Kuwait to bring it up into Iraq. Why would you have to raise the price 4 times to bring oil from Kuwait into Iraq? The only reason is that you're exploiting the system. So there was plenty of money for corruption, plenty of money for special interests, but not enough money to provide adequate protection and armament for the military. This war was entered into without careful thought, without an understanding of what was going to happen. As is made clear in the Downing Street memos, this administration had no idea what they were going to do after the initial battle. Now, there was no question. Everyone who had any idea about the strength of the Iraqi military knew that the American military was going to be able to snap them instantly. There was no competition, effectively. Hardly any of our servicemen were injured or killed during the initial battle. Some were, but a very, very small number, and a number of those by friendly fire. So we knew that our military was going to be able to win the battle. That was not a question. But they had no idea whatsoever about what they were going to do afterwards. None whatsoever. And that's why we're stuck in this quagmire now, which is getting more and more intense and more difficult. And the military, as a consequence, is getting weaker and weaker. Yes, ma'am?
The question is that Halliburton, of course, was paid to build a permanent prison in Guantanamo. The number of people that we have in prison, frankly, I don't know the exact number. Pardon?
500.
Yes, but we have prisoners in Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, we have them in Abu Ghraib, we have them in Camp Cropper, we have them in a number of other places, and we have prisoners that we've sent out to other countries. So we don't know the exact number. It's a very large number, and none of these people have been charged, let alone tried. None of them have been charged with anything, and we're faced with this unconscionable situation where, as a result of having engaged in an unjust, illegal, unnecessary war, we are creating a vast array of problems for ourselves. And those problems include a weakened military, construction of prisons. One of my colleagues in the Senate received an awful attack from the right wing because he compared this prison system to a gulag archipelago. But if you look at it objectively, that seems to be what it is becoming. Seems to be what it's becoming. And now, more money is being sent to build more prisons. We had a relatively, very, very important, but relatively confined problem to deal with after the attack of September 11th. The Al-Qaeda network, which attacked us, and which was responsible for the attack on the World Trade Center in 1993, which was responsible for the attack on the destroyer Nicole, and responsible for the attack on the U.S. embassies in East Africa. The Al-Qaeda network was a relatively small group of people. We had a good idea who was in charge of them, where they were, how they were operating, and if we had just focused our attention on the people who were responsible for attacking us and killing people in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, instead of diverting attention for the private, personal, and political reasons of the Bush family to attack Iraq, our military would not be as weak as they are today. The prison system that we're confronting and building more would not exist. The attitude of people around the world toward us would not be what it is, becoming less and less every day. The budget deficit or the cost of this war would not be what it is. We would have the situation under control. But the problems that we're confronting are the results of the falsities that this administration carried on when it decided to attack Iraq for no reason. And that's why we're confronting all of these difficult issues. That's at the heart of the problem. And the story in the Press and Sun Bulletin today, all of those issues that were raised in that story, none of those conditions would exist if the war in Iraq had not been started. But of course, the writer of that story is not going to say that, because his job is to try to propagandize the American people and to get them to think that if we start thinking about stopping the war in Iraq, we're going to get into more trouble, rather than if we end the war in Iraq in an intelligent and rational way, all of the problems that we're confronting as a result of it are going to stop. Yes.
I appreciate so much you as our representative. Some of us deeply believe that the president and the vice president and many of his group have really continued to commit high crimes against this nation and against the Constitution. And we believe strongly that this man and his group should be impeached. Senators to represent us, and I think they're being paid very well. We also recognize for this impeachment and conviction to take place, we would need bipartisan support. We realize, too, that we are objects of a media that tries, with the help of the administration, to influence us in the wrong direction. My question to you, Representative Hinchey, is given the fact that you are probably one of the most powerful people, along with the other people in Congress in this country, and you have a source of information that doesn't depend upon the media, one, are you sensing any bipartisan support for the insights that you have to offer? Secondly, do you get a sense, could you help us to understand why the other representatives and the senators, including our own senators, Senator Schumer and Senator Clinton, do not have or don't seem to be willing to share the insights and the knowledge that you so eloquently present to us, is there any hope before the 2006 election that knowledge will break forward in your colleagues to bring us to a point where we will not have to endure what we're enduring as a nation right now?
Thank you very much. There is some hope. It's a small amount that something material will happen between now and the election of 2006. And I hope that the election of 2006 will bring us a different Congress so that we can begin to address this problem in the proper fashion, begin to hold the congressional hearings, and begin to bring the appropriate charges against those who acted unjustly and illegally and thereby cost the lives of a large number of people. In the meantime, there are some things that are beginning to happen. Not much, but some. I had a conversation on the floor of the House before I left for the July 4th break with a man by the name of Walter Jones from South Carolina. Walter Jones is a man that I regard highly and respect deeply. He's a man of integrity. He's a Republican. He represents an area including Camp Lejeune. And he said to me that he feels such deep guilt for having voted for the war resolution that Bush presented to the Congress back in October of 2002. He said every day of his life, he feels deeply remorseful as another 1, 2, 3, 5 dozen people die in Iraq as a result of that war resolution. And he is working with me and with the others of us in the Congress to try to do something about this in the meantime. And the number of people that are beginning to move in this direction is increasing. When I started to talk the way I talk about this war, back between the attack on the World Trade Center and October of 2002, there was hardly anyone who was speaking the way that I did. There were people who had voted against the war resolution. 133 members of the Congress voted against the war resolution. 127 Democrats and 6 Republicans. But there were very few people who were speaking out against it. But that's changing. More and more people are beginning now to speak out against it in the House of Representatives. And the numbers of those of us who are opposing it and trying to develop a policy to bring about an end to this kind of activity and also to bring integrity back into the American media, the number of people is growing. Recently, I formed a caucus. A caucus in the House of Representatives is an informal organization of members of the House devoted to a specific issue or task, in addition to all the other things that we have to do, of course. But this particular caucus that I formed is called the Future of American Media Caucus. And the purpose of this caucus is to focus attention on the kinds of things that are going on in the American media, to help the American people understand the decline in integrity that we're experiencing in the American media, the rise in propaganda coming out of the administration, and in which several aspects of the media are cooperating, and to bring back what the Supreme Court said was necessary in 1945. In 1945, the Supreme Court of the United States said that in order for the maintenance of this democratic republic, it is essential that we have a diverse and antagonistic media so that all points of view can be expressed. What the people in charge of our government today want is one point of view being expressed over and over again, and no alternative points of view. That is the most critical battle we have. More important than anything else, if we don't win that battle, then virtually everything else can be lost. So the Future of American Media Caucus is working hard and growing in numbers. We have 21 members now. We're increasing the membership, working hard to do everything possible to focus attention on the problems that we have and communicating information in our country and restoring the integrity of the American media so the American people can rely on what they see, read, and hear. I'll just give you an example. The question has to do with the treatment that American servicemen and women get, particularly those who are injured and otherwise when they return home. I received a letter from a constituent about a week ago involving their son, who was an Iraq veteran, wounded, came back here to the United States, was in Bethesda Naval Hospital, and according to the letter and the exchange of information we've had since then, received adequate attention at Bethesda Naval Medical Center in Maryland, just outside of Washington. Then was sent to a VA hospital in Richmond, Virginia, and the level of attention declined dramatically. That young man's mother had to go down to the hospital and attend to his needs, because there was an inadequate nursing attention in that veterans hospital to attend to the needs of the veterans who were wounded in Iraq and are sent there to recover. It's shameful. It's absolutely disgusting and shameful that we are experiencing that kind of thing in our country with regard to the treatment of our veterans. But we have now just passed additional funding in the House of Representatives. Not as much as the Senate has passed. The Senate is ahead of us on this. They're doing a much better job in providing money for VA hospitals. But this is one of the areas where the administration and the right-wingers in the Congress are arguing, we can't afford it. Big budget deficits. We can't afford it. It is absolutely so deeply hypocritical. But in the context of an appropriations bill that passed last week, we provided a substantial amount of additional funding. We've got to continue to fight on that to make sure that that money goes through and that these young men and women get the best possible care in these veterans' hospitals. That's what they deserve, the best possible care. We have a responsibility to make sure that they get it.
Thoughts on an exit strategy from Iraq. Yes, of course, that is the critical issue. I finally talked about it a little while ago.
The problem is that we have created, as you said very correctly, a terrible, terrible mess. And the bigger, the nastier the mess you create, the more difficult it is to get out of it. But at the same time, the more important it is that you get out of it, because the situation there is just getting worse. So what we need to do, I think, is to set a time, establish a plan, train the Iraqi forces, both at the municipal level for police activities and at the national level for military activities, and to do it honestly. The president has said to us on numerous occasions, back during the campaign last October, he said that there were 160,000 Iraqis trained for police and military activities in Iraq. Today, the number of Iraqis trained to operate on their own, by themselves, either at the municipal or the military level, is less than 3,000. There are a great many others who have had training for a couple of weeks, but they are totally inadequate. We are not providing them with the right kind of training. We need to do that. If we're serious about leaving there, we've got to train Iraqis to take over. Now, a lot of them don't need a lot of training. A lot of them were former police officers or involved in that kind of activity. Others were military personnel. But we've got to train seriously people to take over those obligations and responsibilities. And we need to have a plan that is set forth to leave. Now, some people, when you say that, some people say, all right, you set a date a year from now saying that you're going to leave. That just tells the insurgency when you're going to be out of there, and they'll just lay back and prepare for you to leave. Well, and then they're going to attack. Well, that's what they're doing now. That's what they're doing today. They're attacking more and more and more and more. They're attacking more viciously, more aggressively, more often, killing and wounding more and more people, civilians as well as police officers and American military personnel. So that argument just doesn't wash. We need to set a date, a time. And the Iraqi government, which has been in office now for a year, needs to prepare itself properly to take over the responsibilities. And we need to involve other people besides ourselves. The United Nations was set up specifically for this purpose. We need to bring in the United Nations. If we're serious about leaving there, instead of being serious about staying there, then that's what we would be doing. We would be starting to bring in alternative forces through the United Nations, including from countries that are Muslim, to begin to take over the responsibilities there. Not exclusively Muslim, but including countries that are Muslim. And there are those countries that are willing to do that. So we need to have a plan. It needs to be organized. We need to set a date. We need to involve the United Nations. And we need to stipulate specific events that will occur during whatever period of time that we set so that we can carry out that plan to get out. Otherwise, it never will happen. You want to follow up?
Yeah, do you believe that the effort to train Iraqis has the appropriate level of urgency, or if there is not that urgency, is that a strategy, so to speak?
Well, I don't know the answer for sure, but I doubt if it is sincere. I doubt if it's sincere because it's not being carried out with any sense of authority or urgency. It's not being carried out carefully, diligently. The number of people that we're training seriously is relatively small. So I don't know what exactly is going on in that regard, other than my thoughts about it are colored by what I know about everything else, which is that it's been done duplicitly and falsely. And maybe this is being done that way too. Yeah.
I guess my question is about the unilateral government. It seems to me, to some extent,
the Attorney General's office, not Alberto Gonzalez or John Ashcroft, but U.S. Attorney General Patrick Fitzgerald from Illinois, his investigation into the Valerie Palmer leak seems to be very fruitful, and like they could be weeks away from some sort of indictment with the grand jury. And I personally think that that's kind of the straw that might break the camel's back. So it's, of all the things, an indictment on the administration would be pretty tough, if not impossible, to spin. So my question to you is, what could Congress potentially do if an indictment comes down against somebody like Mueller? What would Congress do? Compel to do anything? Or would they just sit back and hope it pray?
Well, if, did everyone hear the question? The question is that the investigation that is being carried out by a local U.S. attorney, Mr. Fitzgerald, into the Valerie Plame affair and the revelation of her name, that investigation seems to indicate that it may be fruitful in regard that it may bring about an indictment of somebody in the administration. I don't know if that's the case. If that were to happen, I think it would be very revealing. If some member of the administration were indicted for revealing her name, which is against the law, which is a serious violation of the law to reveal the name of a secret operator within the Central Intelligence Agency, then that person would be brought before a grand jury and then eventually to trial. And during that course of events, other information would be revealed, I would hope, about others who were involved in that process. And then as that began to be revealed, other things would be revealed. Now, if we had the taped conversations of Watergate, of this administration, those taped conversations would be much more fascinating, much more revealing, and show much deeper corruption than were revealed by the Watergate tapes. Much more. But unfortunately, we don't have those tapes. What we have is the revelation of some information. The Downing Street memos are almost an indication that there may be some other tapes around, or other memos, or other sources of information, and we need to keep looking for them. So I don't know if an indictment of anyone, member of the administration, will occur. I think the indictment of the members of the press are troubling, because the First Amendment says specifically freedom of speech and freedom of the press. And if the government begins to interfere with freedom of the press, then that is the beginning of a violation of the First Amendment of the Constitution, the first Bill of Rights. So I'm deeply troubled about that aspect of Mr. Fitzgerald's investigation. I wonder to what extent he has interviewed Mr. Novak, to what extent he has questioned Mr. Novak. What has Mr. Novak revealed to him? And why has he not told us what those revelations are? If Novak is not being investigated, that must mean that he is cooperating with the investigation. If he's cooperating, that must mean there's no other form of cooperation in this regard. It must mean that he has told them who gave him the information. If he's told Fitzgerald who gave him the information, why is Fitzgerald bothering two other reporters, which didn't write, one who didn't write anything about it, and the other who wrote sort of just, you know, half-baked about it? There's a lot here that doesn't meet the eye yet. But your suggestion is that there's a lot under there that can be revealed that could be useful and helpful, and I hope that you're absolutely right.
And she went to jail today.
State of New York, are you going to go into their districts and tell the constituents who are not hearing the truth that this stuff is going on, or are you just going to stay in this very safe district?
Well, I wouldn't exactly call it a safe district, but I'm taking every opportunity to speak out on it. Anybody who asks me to go anywhere to speak to them on this or any subject, I am willing to go, and I do go. And I'm happy to do it. So, ladies and gentlemen, I think we're going to have to come to an end, but maybe another couple of questions, perhaps.
My question for you, Congressman, is, first of all, where are Senator Clinton and Senator Schumer, where do they stand on this issue? But before you answer, I want to thank you and Congressman Conyers and the others who are standing up at your level, making a stand, bringing this to the attention of the people. And I want to let you know that you're not alone, because on this level, if you drive to the west of here between Endicott and Apalachicola, if anyone has seen about 600 flags out there, those aren't for the 4th of July. I have about 1,200 more put out there for the dead U.S. soldiers out there to bring the attention that this war has a horrible cause. Thank you.
I really can't speak for anyone else, and so that question is a difficult question for me to answer. My surmise is I just don't know. The only real thing that I can say here is, let's try to find out. I'm talking to them, you talk to them, write to them, ask them, let's try to find out.
Thank you for coming here tonight. We really appreciate the presentation you've given us. But I'm curious about a couple of things, if you don't mind, two short questions.
Sure.
Your presentation tonight has been excellent, very powerful. How is the rest of the American people going to hear this presentation that you've given us so they can realize exactly what's going on? And if you're not sure how they're going to hear this type of presentation, what's the possibility of you going on national TV like Hardball or something and giving this presentation so the rest of the American people can realize what we're realizing tonight?
Well, I'm happy to go on Hardball or any place else and talk about these things. I had an experience fairly recently on the Hannity Combs show where I got into an argument, a real serious argument with Mr. Hannity. And it's not likely that he's ever going to invite me back. But most people who go on these programs are sort of, they just sort of acquiesce to these, hard right-wing guys who are out there. I'm going to continue to speak out on this in every way that I can. I'm going to talk about these things on the floor of the House of Representatives every chance I get. I'm going to take special order times to talk about it in C-SPAN so that anybody who watches C-SPAN will be able to see and hear the kinds of things that we all here tonight have talked about. And I'm going to take every other opportunity I have to speak out on this issue. I think it's absolutely critical. When I started to do this back before the 2002 election, I was criticized by every newspaper in my district, particularly the ones in my hometown in Kingston. They accused me of being unpatriotic for having the nerve to speak out against a wartime president, the way they put it, which meant to me that they had succumbed to the whole line, hook, line, and sinker. They bought into the entire thing. So I've gotten a lot of criticism and come up against a lot of hostility in this situation because of these things that I said, but I feel totally secure in what I'm saying. I've looked at these issues very, very carefully. I've examined them in depth and detail. I've done an enormous amount of reading on this subject, both all kinds of information from a whole variety, a great variety of sources, and I'm very comfortable in what I'm saying. In fact, I fight to restrain myself, because if I don't restrain myself, I'm going to be perhaps a little bit over-aggressive about it and may go a little bit too far. The issue of impeachment came up here tonight, very, very important issue, but before anybody gets to that point, we've got to have investigations. We've got to have a congressional investigation. The United States Senate Intelligence Committee put out a very important report last October. In that report, the Senate Intelligence Committee showed clearly that there was no connection between Iraq and the attack of September 11th, that there was no evidence whatsoever of any weapons of mass destruction in Iraq prior to the immediately prior to the attack, that those weapons had been destroyed, discovered, and uprooted. And then the Senate Intelligence Committee report, the chairman, Chairman Thomas, I think it is, isn't it? Anyway, the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee said that they were also investigating the role of the administration in how they said things were that turned out to be not the case, but they weren't able to do that now. They were going to present that part of their report after the election. The election was in November. This is June. This is July, rather. This is July. And we have had no further report from the Senate Intelligence Committee, and every indication is that they don't intend to produce a report. That's the situation that we face. We need to go after this. It's going to be tough. This is a tough, tough fight because we're fighting from the bottom up. We're fighting from the minority. And we're fighting against powerful and unscrupulous people who have very, very wealthy, very, very powerful allies, some of which control vast aspects of the American media. This is going to be, and is now, and has been, a very, very tough fight. But it's a fight that we have to continue because the future of our country is at stake. I thank you all very, very much.
That was a community forum on the Downing Street memos on the war in Iraq with Congressman Maurice Hinchey, held July 6th in Binghamton, New York. Hinchey identified the state of the American media as one of our most serious national problems. Since you're listening to this program, you have obviously gotten access to a range of what is called alternative media information. But what is in other countries simply news? People in other countries are generally better informed about the American political landscape than people in this country. For example, here is a piece concerning oil and its role in the invasion of Iraq by Greg Palast that aired on the BBC in March. Palast is an American who cannot get work in this country airing the types of stories you are about to hear.
Do not destroy oil wells.
Attack! Don't attack Iraq!
The ongoing aspects of Operation Iraqi Liberation.
No war crimes! Don't attack Iraq!
The action is nothing to do with oil or any of the other conspiracy theories put forward.
Some people believe George Bush had a secret plan for Iraq oil. It's not that simple. In fact, we found two plans. While there was a hot war being fought in Iraq, here in Washington, there was a cold war being fought. On one side, the Pentagon and its neocon friends, and on the other, the State Department and its allies in big oil.
So help me God.
January 2001, George Bush waltzes into office on a gusher of oil money, swearing that the U.S. has no plans to remake any nation. Yet, at the same time, on the other side of the USA, a secret meeting was in the works to plan for the invasion of Iraq, to overthrow Saddam, and to decide what to do with Iraq's oil. Across the bridge from San Francisco, the State Department convened the meeting in this house, a bit of Baghdad in America. Falah al-Jabouri is an Iraqi exile who acted as Ronald Reagan's back channel to Saddam's regime. He hosted those early war councils for the Bush team.
It's an invasion, but it will act like a coup.
Falah al-Jabouri.
The original plan was to liberate Iraq from the Saddamists and from the regime, to stabilize the country, a leader, an Iraqi leader known for his decency and ability to work with the Allied forces, will step forward.
Al-Jabouri, a key link between big oil, big finance, and OPEC, interviewed the candidates for a strongman to replace Saddam in advance of the invasion.
This transitional leader that we have interviewed before will come in, head all of the government systems, and quickly bring the people back to work.
In other words, just topple Saddam. Most Baathists would stay in power. As for the oil fields, the state would keep ownership. But after September 11, Washington's power center shifted to the right. Paul Wolfowitz and his neocons were now in charge. Newsnight learned they junked Plan A, the quick coup. The neocons wanted to use the invasion of Iraq to end the Arab stranglehold on oil. They aimed to bring down the criminal OPEC monopoly.
OPEC is a cartel.
Ari Cohen, Heritage Foundation.
As a cartel, it regulates the output, and it tries to get the price as high as possible for its members without destroying the goose that is laying the golden eggs. So OPEC, the Organization for Petroleum Exporting Countries, would behave in a way that, at least in this country, in the United States, would be prosecutable.
At the heart of the Smash OPEC scheme was a radical plan, which we discovered in this document, completed a month before the invasion, for the privatization of all Iraq's assets, especially in the oil and supporting industries.
By having massive oil holdings in private hands that are not marching to the drumbeat of OPEC, you weaken OPEC politically and you improve the lot of a consumer and of Western economy in general.
Chatter about the sell-off plan boosted accusations that the invasion was aimed at seizing Iraq's oil.
The thought was, why are you going into Iraq? It's about oil, isn't it?
Robert Ebell, State Department, Future of Iraq Project, formerly CIA.
And my response was, no, it's about getting rid of Saddam Hussein. The morning after, it's about oil. These people have been out of Iraq for some time. To privatize, to get, you know, lots of companies in, get them spending money to develop production.
Resistance to the plan to sell off Iraq's oil bubbled up from a most unlikely source, U.S. oil chieftains. Former Shell CEO Philip Carroll was called up long before the tanks rolled.
I received a call from someone in the Pentagon saying that they were doing some contingency planning in association with the possibility of war in Iraq. They needed some help and assistance from someone who had spent time in that industry.
But the oil man refused to carry out the neocon plan.
There were models everywhere from the total privatization to partial privatization, et cetera, et cetera. There were all sorts of ideas floated about the economy of Iraq and what ought to be done. I was very clear that there was to be no privatization of Iraqi oil resources or facilities while I was involved. End of statement.
Even some of those who plotted Saddam's overthrow complained that privatization plans added fuel to the insurgency, costing American, British, and Iraqi lives.
Salah al-Jabouri.
Insurgents and those who wanted to destabilize new Iraq have used this as means in saying, look, you're losing your country, you're losing your leadership, you're losing all of your resources to a bunch of wealthy people, bunch of billionaires in the world, want to take you over and make your life miserable. And we saw an increase in the bombing of oil facilities, pipelines, of course, built on the premise that privatization is coming.
So how is the State Department going to douse the flames?
Here in Houston, the oil capital of America, the industry wasn't too happy about what was going on.
Newsnight discovered that big oil chieftains in Iraq demanded a new policy. The job fell to the Texas think tank founded by Jim Baker, one-time Secretary of State, whose law firm now represents George W. Bush, the government of Saudi Arabia, and Exxon Oil.
The bottom line is we were very concerned about the perceptions that somehow we were doing this to steal the oil.
Amy Jaffe, James Baker Institute.
You cannot use military means to impose privatization, it has to come from the society below. That has to be what the country wants to do. We were very concerned that there were going to be images on Al Jazeera TV or in Western media that was very to the left showing the Americans standing with military uniforms on in the oil field.
The State Department reluctantly handed us the plan, confidential until now, drafted by Jaffe. There are 7 options given to Iraq's future governments, not a single one privatization. The neocon scheme was dead because taking on OPEC and forcing down the price of petroleum did not suit big oil.
I'm not sure that if I were the chairman of an American company and you put me on a lie detector test, that I would say that I thought high oil prices were bad for me or my company.
So I asked Shell's former boss if the neocons' agenda matched that of the oil industry.
They are absolutely poles apart. Many neoconservatives are people who do have certain ideological beliefs about markets, about democracy, about this, that, and the other. International oil companies, without exception, are very pragmatic commercial organizations. They don't have a theology. They don't have a doctrine. They are going to do what is in the best interest of their shareholders.
Americans have never paid so much for gasoline. Big oil execs are grinning. They've never seen such big profits. The neocons say, we missed the chance to stop this run-up in oil prices. All we had to do was sell off Iraq's oil fields.
But big oil killed it.
Philip Carroll, former CEO, Shell Oil.
The question, both politically and economically, would be so complex and so difficult that I don't think anyone really serious would think about trying to privatize it.
Ari Cohen, Heritage Foundation.
In that case, let's go and nationalize Shell to follow his logic. I think that in the late 20th century, early 21st century, to compare government-run industries with privately-run industries, it's a no-brainer, as we say. The comparison is in favor of privately-owned oil, privately-owned assets.
I would agree with that statement. To privatize would be a no-brainer. It would only be thought about someone by someone with no brain.
Headless or heartless, America has given Iraq a state-controlled oil monopoly. Big Oil and OPEC will have their $56 a barrel oil, and Wolfowitz and the neocons are looking for new jobs.
That was Greg Palast reporting last March for the BBC. For more of Palast's work, you can visit his website, gregpalast.com, GREGPALAST.com. And thanks to American Independence Radio for the Lies Montage. You can contact us and download MP3s of this program at our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by you.